The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, good morning, and can you hear me all right, everyone? Loud enough? So, I hope that especially those of you who needed it got an extra hour of sleep last night. I read recently that the number of traffic accidents go down. Turn it up a little bit. Is it off out there? Is it all just this low? So let's see. Is that I always sit and wait to hear if it's louder, but I have to talk. Is that better? So I read that traffic accidents go down the Monday after the fall daylight savings change, and they go up after the spring, the Monday after the spring daylight savings change, because people get less sleep then. I like to tell people that as a whole, Americans need sleep more than they need meditation. So some of you know, who track these things, that one of the famous baseball players of the American baseball players died recently, Yogi Berra. And there's a Yogi Berra story of, it was a World Series, and Yogi Berra was a catcher. And so the opposing team, Hank Aaron, was one of the greatest American batters, was up for bat. And so part of Yogi Berra's job, the way he took his job, was he would try to distract the opposing batters. So he told Hank Aaron that when he came up to swing, he said, "Oh, you're holding the bat wrong." The copyright needs to be facing you. You know, I guess it's a copyright or something on that. And so the pitch came, and Hank Aaron hit a home run. And so he ran around the bases, and he came back to Yogi Berra, and Hank Aaron said to Yogi Berra, "I didn't come up here to read." So, you know, he didn't get distracted. So it's been said many times now that we live in an age of distraction. And so part of the task, if this is true, for all of us, is to become wise about distraction and how distraction works. And one of the great places to study that is in meditation. Distraction is both a problem, and distraction can be used wisely. It's an important part of life. It's a problem when it fragments us and makes us more unsettled. It supports us when it brings us together and helps us to become settled. So if we're very stressed out and contracted and tight, sometimes distraction actually helps, and people use that sometimes as a de-stressor and take our attention off what we're kind of preoccupied about. And sometimes people it's the very act of being distracted that keeps the mind kind of in a loop of tightness and anxiety and distractibility and kind of jumping around, and it's kind of alienating from ourselves. And so to be able to notice the difference and know how these things work is part of the, I think, a wise life. The word distract in Latin means to draw apart. So, you know, our attention is drawn away from what we want to focus on, perhaps. But also, there's a way I think of it as we're kind of fragmenting ourselves. One of the great challenges of our lives is having multiple concerns, jumping around here and there, grabbing onto things. The monkey mind that the Buddhism likes to talk about, where you grab for the next branch before you've let go of the first. So just always grabbing for something. The cost of that is that we're not holistic, we're not whole. Our attention is partial. We're not settled in our body. The awareness is not coming out of a relaxed, open, inclusive place, but rather we're kind of like blinders on. Sometimes when there's a lot of distraction, we are, mental distraction, that only certain parts of our faculties, intelligence, is being used. I've heard of one teacher who tells his students, I think these are college students, that of a British study, in a psychiatric journal, he says, that when people are texting while they're doing something else or checking social media while doing something else, their intelligence drops, their IQ drops by 10%. And he tells his students that because he has an issue with his students constantly. And I teach graduate classes sometimes, and it's quite something to see people, they have their little devices. I wonder what's going on behind those devices. I mean, either I'm saying brilliant things, and they're keeping notes, or they're focusing on different things. The cost of distraction, when we talk about the cost of distraction from accidents people have, we get distracted by a phone call, we get distracted by a text, and so our full focus is not on things. There's a whole science, apparently, called interruption science, and it has to do with the study of how people's work habits get interrupted at work, and how people are less efficient at work when they're constantly being interrupted by things. And one of the things to be interrupted by is the ping of notifications. And it was interesting, I was thinking about this, and so there was a ping during our sitting today. And it was interesting. It was kind of fine to have it. I didn't mind. It was just a sound. But it made me reflect for a moment that what a difference it was someone else's ping versus my ping. And what happens in my brain when it recognizes my device notification. There's a kind of an impulse to check. There's a desire. There's a movement towards. Whereas that, it was very neutral for me, this ping that arose here in the hall. And it didn't activate anything in my mind except this reflection that I just had. So so do we understand our distraction? So one of the nice things about mindfulness practice is that we're really supposed to pay more careful attention to what's going on. And one of the things that goes on is the distractibility, or the act of being distracted. And so to study that, what happens to you when you get distracted? You're focusing on one thing, and you're no longer focusing on it because your attention is drawn somewhere else. As you do this study and look at it, one of the interesting things to consider is the very way we talk about this stuff, being distractible. Because sometimes very often we use a passive voice. I was distracted by, as if I'm not responsible. I was distracted by, it was just a TV show. I was distracted by the TV show. Don't you have any responsibility? And what would happen if instead of using the word distraction, we say, I gave my attention to? Your boss comes and says, why aren't you working? I was distracted. You get it, maybe then you have a good excuse. But if you say, oh, I gave my attention to, your boss probably wouldn't be very happy then, because that seems intentional. So to what degree is your distraction intentional? If there's a sudden ping, and you're distracted for the moment by that, that I think is innocent enough distraction. But then it's the giving then yourself over to the ping, giving your attention to find out what email was that? What was going on there? If you're driving in your car, and you decided to I was distracted by the TV show on my phone. I don't think that would go over well in court. I think that the understanding is you gave your attention over to it. But why do we give our attention over? What do we why do we allow ourselves to be distracted by things? And so we don't really keep a primary focus on what we're doing. And one of the things is anxiety. Some people are anxious, they're worried, and so the searching and wanting of something for safety, for security, for some answer, some solution to the anxiety. And anxiety is a known kind of motivator for a jumping mind, a searching mind. Another is desire. There can be various, we want something. And we want it. We want comfort, we want solutions, we want entertainment, sometimes we want distraction from things. And what I've noticed in my own mind, if I spend too much time surfing the web and moving kind of quickly through things, that my mind gets in kind of a habit of searching, of wanting. And I don't even, you know, the rest of me doesn't want anything. I'm content. But there's some sort of kind of energy in the mind keeps going. And it's sometimes I've noticed that it just kind of wants to go for it's out of habit almost. Like, let's stay here and keep searching. There must be more things on the web to look at. You know, searching and checking. And it's not very settled. It's not very relaxed. For me, it brings all my attention up to, maybe my blood, up into my brain. I feel like center of gravity is in a cognitive world, in my eyes. And there's this kind of drive to search, to want, that goes on. And I suspect I'm not the only one who has this experience with the web, but I'd be very happy to find out I was the only one. And knowing that everyone's, you know, safe from this tendency. And so anxiety, desire, wanting is part of it. And what happens is when we stay in an active mode of constant distraction, constantly jumping around and doing things, and easily pulled by things that pull our attention left and right, and is that we become kind of alienated from ourselves. We come apart from ourselves. We don't really connect it to ourselves. And I think of distractibility or distraction as a cognitive function of what we do with our kind of our ears, our eyes, our mind. And so only part of us is kind of activated. And if it's done too much, we're often too much in the head. And a big part of Buddhist attention, mindfulness, is to help us be settled in our whole being, our whole body. And so that our awareness is holistic and whole rather than fragmented or narrow or have blinders on. So we can be settled when we do things. It's said that most people are much more creative and intelligent when they're relaxed and settled. We're better able to problem solve when we're settled in ourselves. If we're anxious and jumping around and easily distracted by things or distracted by our mind, it's much harder to be wise in what's going on. So what I thought I would do is just talk to you a little bit about five different elements of attention. If we want to have a holistic attention, Buddhism holds forth five different parts of this, what attention is, or what contributes to holistic attention. And to have any one of these in isolation kind of leads to a certain kind of imbalance. These five are, those of you who know the Pali words, I'll give you the English. So it's mindfulness, concentration, clear comprehension, wisdom, and letting go. Those are five elements that are a very important part of knowing how to pay attention well. And so the first, mindfulness, is the way these things are talked about by people sometimes get, you know, in different books or different teachers, they all kind of get mixed up or they kind of get overlap each other. So it's So this is my way of presenting it today. So mindfulness is the basic capacity to have present moment attention, for the awareness to be available for the present moment, settled awareness, open awareness to what's going on. And so that takes quite some doing for people whose mind are not in the present moment. If we spend a lot of time thinking about the future, thinking about the past, and it's also quite a bit a deal if the attention is not settled, if people are jumping around a lot with attention, even though they're in the present moment, the monkey mind is operating and scanning and wanting and doing a lot. So the ability to have settled awareness. I think of this awareness as being something that arises out of the body more than something that arises out of the brain. And it certainly has a cognitive side, and probably the brain, in fact, is a huge component part of what it all entails. But all our nerve endings that we have throughout the body are, you know, the antennas for awareness that pick things up. And so to be settled and relaxed and have the sense of awareness or perception or arise out of the body rather than out of the mind is, I think, makes awareness much more holistic and much easier to be relaxed. When I first started practicing many years ago, if someone had asked me where awareness resides, I would have pointed to my head, the top of my head. After 20 years of practice, maybe, I don't know how long, someone asked me where awareness resides, I would have pointed to my torso. And that's kind of where the center was. And now if someone asks me, if you ask me, I would just spread my arms really wide and just say, here. It's almost like it's not localized, but it's all inclusive of everything. It's here. And for me, if my awareness goes too much in the head, then it actually feels like my world has gotten smaller. And as awareness opens up, my world tends to be much more open or spacious, or I become bigger and more open or something. So to cultivate present moment awareness. But that's not enough. That's not all that attention is. And the second thing that is important in Buddhism is focused awareness, or what's called sometimes concentration. And this is the ability to choose something useful to pay attention to and maintain the focus there. And as some people know in ordinary life, that one of the great joys of life is to be absorbed in an activity. And to really give ourselves over and become one. My wife is telling me stories today, this weekend, about her reading this book, The Boys in the Boat. And some of you have maybe read it, about this person who won, was in a crew on a rowing boat in 1930s Olympics. And so she's reading about how these, they fall into the zone when these 8, 9 crew members, they have to be very strong and they have to be very motivated, self-motivated people, and they have to row exactly in sync. And so they pay very careful attention to what's going on, and they can't pay too much attention to the race, because that's the job of the, what's the person who's sitting in the back? The caller? Coxswain, yeah. And when they really get into the groove and really focus, it brings a certain kind of high. And in many situations, that you're fully giving yourself over to an activity and really being able to focus on it is kind of play. And I think of, the word concentration for me in Buddhism evokes the connotations of play. It doesn't, some people it arises connotations of work. But for me it's more like play. So it's more like you enter into this absorption, this, you know, real focus, you know, give yourself over to something fully, to what you're doing, and just settle on that. So that ability to stay focused and keep your attention there for some time. As this technology stuff becomes bigger and bigger in our society, there are people who now are discovering that they have to actually take time, like an hour or something at work, where they turn off all their devices except maybe their work on their computer, so they can have uninterrupted work for an hour. Something different happens to the mind, to the body, to our creativity, our engagement, when our work is uninterrupted. So concentration has this also this quality of being uninterrupted focus on a particular thing. And so that's one aspect of attention, concentration. And in Buddhist practice, it's strongly emphasized, the cultivation, development of that capacity. There are some educators and psychologists now who are concerned that as people grow up now in the modern climate, that the neural connections needed for concentration are not being developed because of this technology of being on the web, being on the computer, and Facebook and all these things that people are, social media, that their mind is jumping around a lot, and they're not staying long enough with one thing in this crucial time in the teenage years where these neural connections can be made so they can develop greater capacity of control so they can stay focused and concentrated in what they're doing. And one of the reasons why this is important is, I don't know much about this field of the brain research, but at least what I've read is that they say that the places where in the brain where we can choose to have our attention, to focus our attention, is the same part of the brain that have to do with emotional regulation. So when there's strong emotional experiences, the ability to handle those and to be wise for those and not be caught by them has a lot to do with our ability to be a strong attentional capacity. And concentration is an important part of this ability to get concentrated. The next part of attention is comprehension, and that is gathering information from what we are aware of. So not just being aware and letting sense data and experience just kind of come randomly and not really let it register, but let things register so we clearly comprehend what it is. So if you feel an itch, you recognize it's an itch. If you hear a sound, you recognize that that's a dog barking, perhaps. Or if you feel tight in your shoulders, you recognize it as tightness. So this clear comprehension is a very important part of Buddhism. When you clearly understand, clearly see, clearly cognize, recognize what it is that's happening in the present moment. And there's a lot of information in the present moment, and so you have to also become wise about what information you're gathering. At a certain point in Buddhist practice, teachers will actually encourage people to gather particular kinds of data in their experience. So, for example, gather together information of your breathing and the tensions of your body. Gather together, start noticing how things are changing, the changing nature of things. To have clear comprehension of change is a little bit different than just be aware of things. There's a constant flux and change in my experience and what's going on. Clear comprehension of our intention. So knowing not just, that what's happening in the moment, but our intention, towards what's happening, our relationship to what's happening. So to have understanding. This level of clear comprehension in the tradition is meant to be very rudimentary, very simple. That we just see it for what it is. It's more like field notes. This is what it is. It's the function of the next attentional element, wisdom, that begins to have more understanding of what's there. So analysis, perhaps, occasionally. Understanding the context, understanding the consequences, the process, the cause and effect relationship of things. It's the function of wisdom to understand better what aspect of a present moment experience we pay attention to. What is it that's useful to do? It's a function of wisdom to understand, do we need more mindfulness here? Do we need more concentration here? Do we need more clear comprehension here? Is this a time to contemplate and to reflect a little bit more deeply about what is going on here? And consider what's happening here and what's useful here. My leg fell asleep during the sitting. It doesn't happen that often to me, but I think I was sitting a little bit funny on my cushion. So it fell asleep. So I decided that the right thing to do was to, the wise thing to do was to reflect and contemplate on this. What's the nature of this falling asleep and this pain? Is this something I should be concerned about? Or is this something that's maybe just fine to have and it'll pass as soon as the sitting's over? Or am I pinching a nerve? Or what's going on here? So I spent a minute or two kind of really paying attention to that, and I decided I think it's okay. And it's uncomfortable, and I could change, but maybe this is a nice opportunity for me to learn to be mindful and focused on discomfort. It's a nice thing. And so I didn't move until the sitting was over. So wisdom is an important part. But the wisdom part can be sometimes contemplative and analytical. And some people spend too much time analyzing. too much time thinking about things, and they think that attention is thinking about things. but thinking is thinking, and analysis is only one component part of the overall kind of mandala of attention. And the last that of the intentional elements, or important thing that's yoked or connected to attention in Buddhism, is letting go. So learning to let go of unuseful places for our attention to go. Learning to let go of desires and impulses. Learning to let go of aversions and doubts that we might have. Learning to have some power over the tendencies of the mind, so we're in control rather than the mind is under control. Rather than having our distractions manage us, we want to be able to manage our distractions. And so if what the point is to focus on a particular task and the mind keeps going somewhere else, then learning to let go of that other thing so we can stay focused here develops the capacity to have more freedom, develops the capacity to be able to let go. And this whole world of letting go, learning to let go, is a hugely important topic in Buddhist practice. And to give you one little sense of how it might be important is that it's popularly said that all these devices people have keep people distracted, keep people in a different world. But if you look at you're walking down the street and you come to a red light. You need to cross the street, but it's red, right? It just turned red, so it's going to be red for 30 seconds or a minute. I mean, that's a long time in your precious life. And so, you have greater control over your own life, greater power over your own life. If you don't just sit there as a victim of having to wait for light to turn green, I mean, what a drag, you know? Some city planner is in charge of your life, and you have to sit there, it's your life's pretty limited then. And so a way of kind of, being empowered and autonomous and kind of to take care of yourself is you pull out your smartphone, it brings a certain pleasure and certain delight, taking care of business in your life. It's a great moment, those 30 seconds. And you check your phone. So there's if we analyze, why do we do things like that? Why do we allow ourselves to get distracted or have attention jump around? There might be some really good arguments in your brain of why you think it's so important. But what's lost in the process? What would happen if we let go of the impulse to check the smartphone standing there? Is there something gained? Is there something gained by staying in the present moment with your experiences here and now? Is the opportunity to stand there on the street corner waiting for the light to change an opportunity to get settled into your body, to kind of relax and keep attention develop this open capacity for awareness, relaxed awareness, rather than awareness which is taken hijacked by our desires, our wants, and what we have to do. So as I like to say, in America, there's a very strong emphasis on freedom. And one of the forms of freedom that we emphasize is the freedom to do something. So the freedom to vote tomorrow, Tuesday. The freedom to religion, the freedom to assembly, the freedom to bear arms is important for some people. There's a lot of freedoms to do something. It's not enshrined in the Constitution, but an ideal would be the freedom to shop. For people who have a lot of desires for things, if you were given an unlimited credit card, someone said, here, it's a gift. It's an unlimited amount of money on this credit card. You can use whatever way you want for the rest of your life. Wouldn't that be great? Every desire, you'd be the freedom to act on every desire that required money. Boy, what a freedom, right? The Buddhist analysis says the freedom to act on our desires as important as it is, not to be sometimes limited, but the freedom to act on our desires is a very different freedom than the freedom to not act on our desires. Because if your desires are compulsive, there is no freedom. If you have compulsive desires and you act and you have free ability to act on them, it can feel good. It feels like, you know, there's no limits. You feel this expansivity and it's all good. But it's not real freedom. And Buddhism actually says you're enslaved then by those desires if you're acting on compulsions, even if you have a free access to it. But to be freedom from desire, where the desires arise, but you let go of them, where there's no tendency to pick them up, preserves and more likely can preserve an ease of mind, or can help you find a settledness of mind, or being at home here, a deep contentment here and now that can't be found if we're shopping all the time. I've heard of college students who are listening to lectures in college, and this is what maybe some of my students are doing, but I don't check. And they're shopping. They're on Amazon, you know. It seems like what's driving that. So an undistracted attention, to learn how to cultivate non-distractibility, doesn't mean that our attention doesn't pick up what's going on in our environment, attention doesn't move around to different things. It means we don't get lost in those things, that we maintain a freedom in the middle of our attention. There's a sense of freedom in attention, a freedom how we use attention, a clear understanding of what's happening to our attention, that we are the masters of our attention, that attention, our capacity for attention, is one of the most precious treasures that we have. Buddhism calls it a wealth. And if you really want to be wealthy, cultivate a strong capacity of attention. And so you might, if you kind of, as you go about your life and practice, you might add some time to study, on one hand, study what happens when you get distracted. What are the forces inside of you? What's happening inside of you when you get distracted? What are the conditions that are present in your mind, in your heart, when you're easily distracted? How useful is it for you? How much do you benefit from being distracted and having your attention jump around? Is it an alternative? And one alternative that Buddhism champions is the alternative of having settled, liberated attention. And if what you want is to discover settled, liberated attention, then these five elements of attention are worth paying attention to. Mindfulness, concentration, comprehension, wisdom, and letting go. And how those five work together in harmony is part of the task of a Buddhist meditator, is to have them all working in harmony. So those are my thoughts this morning. We have about 6 minutes. If you'd like to ask any questions, or if you'd like to distract me with some other topic. It's all the way in the back. Is there a mic near the back there? We can pass back there.
Thank you for this topic this morning. I just want to mention that I read an article, and there is new software called Freedom, which you can put on your computer that will completely block any sites you want to block or block the internet completely so that you can work without distraction.
Nice. Freedom. Nice. So up here in the front, is there...
Hello. Thank you very much for the talk. So I have an app called Forest, where you can grow trees instead of looking at other websites. But the question I had was, I've been watching hindrances, I think they are. And so a question that came up for me was, how do I believe, or why should I believe, love more than ill will? Like these strong things that come up. Some of them are very unpleasant, so they're easy to disbelieve. But there are some things that come up that are very pleasant. So,
in the realm of ill will?
No.
Oh. The question is,
but why should I believe love more than
ill will?
Yeah.
So it's a great question. I guess I said something recently like that, right? So you're holding me accountable. can I turn it back on you? Since it's an important question for you to ask, why would a person believe ill will more than love?
Maybe to do with their experience.
Please, say
some more. So there's some confusion, because if the experience is more of one than the other, then which is real?
I see, yeah.
And it's a cultivation issue, I think. Which do I I wish to cultivate more love, but if I'm feeling a lot of, do I believe it?
Yeah. So some people grow up with a lot of ill will around them, and they just think that's real. That's what's supposed to be. That's how you make yourself safe. That's how you make connections with people. That's just how it's done. And so there's a lot of positive reinforcement for the value of it. Some people find themselves in situations of danger, and the expression of ill will, of anger, for example, and hostility, if it's strong enough, protects them. And so it's very, very can be very effective in the short term to protect one or get what you want. You can intimidate people, and it can be very rewarding to intimidate people, because you get what you want, maybe. And so it's reinforced through that way. So that's some of the reasons why. My belief is that we have to learn how to take care of ourselves well, and ill will implies hostility. There can be a ferocious saying no. There can be ferocity, protecting yourself that doesn't have to involve any kind of hostility. But why love? Why should we believe love more than ill will? I think in the bigger picture, if we use love wisely, we become safer. If we use love wisely, we're more deeply connected to ourselves. I think that hostility and ill will is kind of it's a narrowing and a tightening of our being, so that only part of us is settled. We're kind of disconnected from the wholeness of who we are. I associate love with being whole, being connected. Love that's healthy comes out of a very relaxed, open, contented kind of feeling and presence, or at least it moves us in that direction more and more. And that in the long term, if we can act from love, we create more safety for ourselves and the world around us, rather than the short-term benefits of ill will and hostility. So I'll give you one example of that. When I used, I didn't think I was using ill will. When my kids were young, I very occasionally used my strong voice. Sometimes I'd say, I'll have to. Once I said to my son, if you continue doing this, I'm going to get angry. And but I just said that, I said it, I tried to say it in an ordinary tone of voice, and he looked at me, cocked his head and looked at me and said, Dad, you're already angry. Occasionally I use a strong voice. Basically, the strong voice was to say, no, you can't do that, because the acting out, the difficult challenge was so hard. And then one day, I heard my older son use that tone of voice on his younger brother. And I said, oh my God, what have I created? What have I done? I thought I was just taking care of an issue in the moment. But he learned how to behave from that. And I was horrified. what happened. So you know, the short-term benefits of ill will are, or the long-term problems of ill will, I would say the short-term benefits of ill will are a lot less than the long-term harm that it causes. The short-term challenges of learning how to love is compensated by the long-term benefits that it can happen. So I think it's just much better to love than to have hostility. And they say it's better for your health, too. Great. So thank you for coming today and sitting here. And I hope that this first day of our new time zone is nice for you. Thank you.